order the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness. And I open the public hearing on House Bill 2154, and the committee administrator will share a brief explanation of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2154 is a bill that would limit the conditions under which the Department of Justice could deny reimbursement to medical providers for safe medical examinations. Those are sexual assault forensics examinations. Also under the measure, the payment for examinations could not be denied in cases where the victims have not yet reported the assault, are unsure about their desire to cooperate with the criminal investigation and prosecution, or for those cases when the victim's identity is not available.
Okay, and I think we have a special guest, Attorney General Hardy Myers. Would you like to come up and testify, Attorney General? We're going to invite you not to pull that down. We have a terrible time with that microphone. If you could leave it up there, we're going to hope. Oh, and could please everybody make sure that your cell phones and blackberries and blueberries and raspberries are turned off, not just turned mute, but off, because it affects the sound system. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General. I appreciate the opportunity to offer some brief introductory testimony on behalf of House Bill 2154, which has come to you from what is known as the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. The Sexual Assault Task Force was formed in 1999, and the impetus for its formation came from victim advocates and others who saw a lack of improvement in sexual assault response as a key societal concern in Oregon. These concerned citizens organized a statewide multidisciplinary gathering to assess how Oregon addresses sexual adult and adolescent sexual assault. In May of 1999, 130 people, and I also attended that conference, spent 2 days at the Sexual Assault Summit assessing needs and identifying strategies for meeting them. The top needs identified as keys to improving the response to sexual assault were adequate, specific, and quality training for responders, more financial resources to improve local response, adequate, specific, and consistent data, and closer and more cooperative local collaboration in the response to sexual assault. And from the conference also came a request that I form a statewide sexual assault task force to help meet these needs. And since its formation, the task force has established annual priorities in order to meet its objectives. The task force has 48 official members appointed by me. 12 of these members fill agency-specific slots, and their respective organizations choose a representative for appointment, and all other slots are open for application. Task force members serve a 2-year term. Numerous other interested parties participate in the task force. And the task force has 10 active committees, each appointed task force member serves on a committee, subcommittee, or work group. The committees, subcommittees, and work groups are comprised of appointed members and non-members and are open to interested individuals who have both the experience and the expertise necessary to participate in fulfilling each group's annual work plan. And there are also 2 work groups, the Native American Partnership to Address Sexual Assault and the Prison Rape Elimination Act work group. In all, there are about 225 individuals who are serving on the committees, subcommittees, work groups of the task force. One of the standing committees, the Legislative and Public Policy Committee, develops, monitors, and advocates for legislation and public policies that best address the issues of adolescent and adult sexual assault. And in addition, the committee monitors legislation and public policy initiatives relating to sexual assault that are developed by other groups and individuals. The committee is comprised of public policy experts, advocates, attorneys, and other individuals with expertise or interest in legislative and public policy work. I also happen to be a member of that particular committee. The Legislative and Public Policy Committee facilitated a process to gather legislative concepts from task force members. It has done that now for at least the last two sessions. They evaluate various concepts, and this session have brought forward two measures and are co-sponsoring a third. And this measure is one of those three. Heather Buchanan, as to this measure, Heather Buchanan from the task force will be walking you through the provisions of the bill and will be reviewing certain amendments that are going to be recommended to you to further clarify the intended operation of this measure. To sum up, the intent of the bill is to benefit both victims of sexual assault as well as members of the law enforcement community. And representatives from all of those areas were active in the development of this measure and the pending amendments to be presented. And with whatever amendments the committee may choose to make after completing your hearings, I very sincerely hope the committee will recommend passage of this measure as an important part of the total effort to improve the lives of sexual assault victims in Oregon and to enhance the prosecution of sexual assault crimes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Myers. And yes, would you like to introduce yourself?
Good morning, Chair Tomei and committee members. My name is Heather Buchanan, and I'm the training director for the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. I'm pleased to offer testimony in support of House Bill 2154. As Attorney General Hardy Myers indicated, that concept was developed by the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force and all of its membership and is being requested by the Oregon Department of Justice. The intent of House Bill 2154, in its most fundamental essence, is really to eliminate the need for law enforcement authorization prior to the collection of sexual assault forensic evidence kits, or OSP safe kits. We believe that that change will benefit law enforcement, who will then have the opportunity to collect evidence when it's immediately available, which is in the direct aftermath of a sexual assault. We also believe that this will benefit prosecutors, who will then have more access to viable evidence for the investigation and prosecution of sex crimes. And finally, we believe this will benefit victims of sexual assault, who will have time to come forward without losing the option of a viable investigation and prosecution. The way the process currently stands is that you need to report to law enforcement immediately when you respond to the hospital if you want to have evidence collected. And as we know, working with victims, law enforcement, advocacy, prosecutors, medical professionals, that many times in that direct aftermath, survivors are unsure as to whether or not they're ready to report, but may come back in a week or 2 weeks later and want to make that report to law enforcement. It is our hope that we can change the 789 of Oregon laws to provide victims an opportunity to have that evidence collected immediately when it's available, and then when they change their minds, that will be a part of the investigation, will be readily available to both law enforcement and prosecutors. I'd also like to add that the task force conducted a nationwide survey of state sexual assault coalitions, and we were very pleased to find that approximately 31 states already have existing provisions for the collection of forensic evidence without reporting to law enforcement. So I'll provide a copy of that data to Mr. Smith at the conclusion of this hearing.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the witness?
Yes, Madam Chair. I have several questions, and it's regarding specifically lines 28, 29, 30, and then the next page, 1 and 2. And as I read it, it says a medical assessment can be obtained regardless of whether the victim reports. And then on the next page, let's just back up to that first page. And if I read this correctly, I'm assuming you go to a medical facility, and a medical facility, ER, can say, excuse me, but we need to collect. evidence because we have a suspected sexual assault. Is that correct?
The context in which evidence would be collected currently and also with these changes would be when a survivor identifies as a victim of sexual assault and consents to evidence collection. So what's reflected in the current law is that the fund will pay regardless of whether or not survivors report, but it doesn't provide for the opportunity for the collection of the OSP safe kits regardless of whether or not survivors report. Excuse me, Representative Tomei and Representative Marr.
Follow up. I guess what I'm getting at is a situation where the hospital says you must provide this evidence, even though the victim acknowledges that they may have been the victim of a sexual assault, but that they don't want to give up the evidence. I mean, how is that played out here?
Chair Tomei and Representative Marr, my understanding of current practice as well as current law is that you cannot conduct medical forensic procedures on anyone without the consent of the patient.
Okay. Thank you, because that's where I was going.
Okay.
I didn't want the hospital to be perceived as, you know, in a liability situation where they didn't collect it and then the victim comes back and says, well, you should have required me to, you know, to give up that information. So thank you very much for clearing that up.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Right. Thank you.
Cameron Campbell. And why don't we bring up Cindy Smith also?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Campbell. I am the Director of Training for the Oregon Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I am also a member of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force and serve on the Criminal Justice Subcommittee of that task force. And it is not so much in my position as the Director of Training for DPSST that I'm here today, but more from my position as a law enforcement officer. I have been a law enforcement officer for the past 27 years. I came to Oregon, one of the best kept secrets in the country, I think, from the state of Maine. And while working in the state of Maine, was a member of a sexual assault response team, and we worked, and I served as a member of a committee that actually worked on developing the statute in Maine that addresses this very same issue. That was about 7 or 8 years ago that we worked on that, and that statute was passed to allow for the collection of the safe kit without the mandated notification to law enforcement or without the authorization of law enforcement, and found that in fact it did not necessarily, it did result in additional evidence kits being collected, but more importantly, I think it provided the survivors of sexual assaults the opportunity to have that evidence collected without the immediate trauma, if you will, of proceeding through the investigative stage. They had an opportunity to have the evidence collected that may be important and then report to law enforcement several days or a week later after seeking counsel and advice perhaps from family members or others and then proceeding forward with that step. The evidence is crucial. The physical evidence is crucial to the successful prosecution of many of the sexual assault cases. And it seems to me that any impediment that we place sort of in the way of the collection of that evidence it does not necessarily serve the system or the community well, and certainly not the survivors. I think we need to offer them the opportunity to think the matter through, make the decision on their own whether or not they choose to proceed with the report to law enforcement and the prosecution of the case after that. but give them the opportunity to provide that evidence that would be crucial to the successful prosecution of the case without mandating that they report the case to law enforcement first.
Thank you. Any question? The witness? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, and you are Cindy Smith.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Cindy Smith, and I'm a nurse practitioner and a certified sexual assault nurse examiner at the University of Oregon Health Center. Our health center is one of the few programs in the country that have a trained sexual assault nurse examiner on staff to collect forensic evidence from a sexual assault victim. We developed our program after years of caring for sexual assault victims that came to us because they did not want to be seen in the emergency room, and they had not yet made a decision about reporting to law enforcement. Last school year, we saw 13 sexual assault cases, 10 of which did not want to report to law enforcement at the time of their initial visit. This academic school year, we have seen 8 sexual assault cases, 4 of whom did not want to report at the time of their initial exam. It's not uncommon for us to later hear that one of these students would now like to report the sexual assault to law enforcement. For example, in October, I saw a student who was raped by a stranger in an alley while walking home from a friend's house. It was her friends that called the clinic and brought her in, as she could not even talk on the phone to make an appointment. She arrived at the clinic within several hours of the assault, not having showered, and with the clothes she had worn at the time of the assault in a bag. All of these very helpful steps in being able to best collect and preserve evidence. During the interview, it was so upsetting and painful for her to tell me the details of the assault that when I informed her that to collect an evidence kit, I would need to involve law enforcement, she declined to go forward with that part of the exam. I cannot fully express to you how frustrated I felt that day, not with the victim, but rather with the system, knowing that, as I did the rest of her medical exam, I could not collect forensic evidence at the same time, and that any evidence would now be lost forever. I realized at the time that it took all the courage this student had to even come to our clinic, let alone make a decision about involving law enforcement. Unfortunately, a week later, I saw the same student back for a follow-up visit, and it was then that she said she would not like to see what happened to her happen to someone else, and that now she would like me to help her get in contact with law enforcement. This is not an unusual case when it comes to sexual assault follow-up at our clinic. We developed our program with every intention of being able to collect evidence in a timely manner and allow the victim an opportunity to consider all their options. The current requirement for law enforcement authorization to collect a sexual assault forensic kit is by far the biggest obstacle we face in having a successful sexual assault nurse examiner program in our clinic. I thank you for your time, and I urge you to support this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions of this witness? Thank you both very much for coming. Jennifer Stevens and Jane Downing. And thank you all for writing so legibly.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Stevens. I am a nurse in the Salem Hospital Emergency Department. I have been doing sexual assault exams for the last 5 years, and for the last 2 years have served as the sexual assault coordinator at the hospital. We have victims come in many states, and if you're familiar with the process of dealing with the victimization, they often come in states where they don't want to face the fact that they will have to go through a law enforcement investigation. And there is a very delicate time frame to collect that evidence. It's not uncommon for someone to come into our emergency department and say, I want a rape kit. And when we look at them and say, okay, we have to report this to law enforcement, they stop that process right there. There's an 84-hour window of time where that evidence can be collected. I would like to speak specifically to one case that stands out in my mind. We had a person come in who was a very high profile in her community, was sexually assaulted, and because of her high profile, she had no intention of following through at that time. she was referred to Women's Crisis Center and received some counseling, later decided that she would like to report, but it was well beyond that time. A lot of these people come in not having showered, as Cindy spoke to, having the clothing that they that holds evidence that is that invaluable at the time, but without the ability to collect that evidence, and as it stands now, report it to law enforcement, we lose that. With this bill and supporting it, we would be able to collect that evidence, preserve it, and give them the time they need to heal and be able to face that law enforcement investigation. So I urge you to support this bill.
Thank you. Any questions of the witness? Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and committee members. My name is Jane Downing, and I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service. We've been around for 33 years serving the needs of sexual assault victims and domestic violence victims in Marion County. And one of the things that we see on a regular basis are sexual assault victims that right after the assault, they're not sure what they need to do. They don't know where they need to go in order to get help and support. They're often confused. And they need some support to be able to say, you know, I may not want to report right now, but I may want to report down the road. And this bill will be able to give them that opportunity. You've heard so eloquently the stories, and I could tell you hundreds of stories about survivors who have face the difficult choice of whether do I report or do I not report, do I go through the system. And as you all, I'm sure, are well aware, it can be a very difficult decision to make. I urge you to support House Bill 2154 because it will make a difference in the lives of the survivors that are in your communities all over the state of Oregon. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. I've also submitted written testimony that has more information, but I know time is short and I want to be respectful of the committee's time. Thank you for letting us come and talk to you about this really important bill.
Thank you for the testimony and for both of you for the work you do. Thank you. Any questions of the witnesses? All right. Thank you very much. Cynthia Stensa and Sybil Hip.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I am from the Department of Justice Crime Victims Assistance Section, and I simply wanted to say, as the section of the Department of Justice that administers the SAVE fund on a day-to-day basis, makes those payments to the medical providers when they bill us for either a partial or full medical assessment and forensic exam, we are fully in support of this bill and urge you to pass it on.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. The Oregon Law Center, as you may know, provides legal assistance to low-income people across Oregon. And we prioritize the provision of services to the neediest Oregonians, and for that reason, we focus a good deal of our attention on the provision of services to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault who are in need of assistance in obtaining safety measures to help them. And I just want to voice our support of this excellent bill and indicate that this would bring Oregon into compliance with the national protocols on this issue as recommended by the Department of Justice. And we think it will be just a great protection for the safety and privacy, but also the dignity of survivors in the aftermath of assault. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions of the witness? Thank you very much, Ms. Hip. And we have one more. And if there's anyone else who wishes to testify, I think someone has come in who said they wanted to testify. I don't have their name here. Come. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this? And if you would identify yourself, please.
Representative Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Terry Quinteros. I'm the program director for Crime Survivors for Community Safety. We're a program of Partnership for Safety and Justice located in Portland. And we bring together everyone who has been impacted by violence and crime, including survivors, people accused and convicted of crime, and the families of both, to create criminal justice reform and more healing services for survivors. I have also been an advocate, a direct service advocate for domestic and sexual violence survivors for about 18 years. And we'll just make some brief points because I agree with all of the testimony given so far. We support this bill because it allows survivors the option of deciding at a later time after their trauma has perhaps lessened a little bit and they have some time to think about whether or not they want to prosecute or not. In my experience, when people have experienced any kind of trauma, it's really difficult to focus and make decisions in that moment. And so we really support any time that a survivor is given the opportunity to have other choices in their life.
Thank you so much for testifying.
Thank you.
Any questions of the witness? Thank you again.
Thank you.
Anyone else who wishes to testify on this?
Chair Tomei.
Yes.
Before we conclude, I just wanted to thank the Attorney General for his focus on this issue. You've been a tremendous advocate on sexual assault issues, and I wanted to thank you and thank everyone for testifying today. Without the task force and I think the good work, we wouldn't have such, you know, well thought out legislation to consider, so thank you.
I would second that. Thank you. Any other questions or concerns? I think they're still working on some amendments on this, so we will not be having a work session on this today. And so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2154. And thank you all for coming and for all the work that you've done. Thank you so much. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2128, and the committee administrator will be giving us some information on that.
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 2128 would reauthorize the Sexual Assault Victims Emergency Medical Response Fund, also known as SAVE, by repealing a sunset provision that exists within the current statute.
Okay. Do we have anybody? Great. So Cynthia Stinson is going to speak with us again. Sybil, I think you're going to be next, so why don't you come on up, too. Go ahead and testify. You don't have to wait.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the director of the Crime Victims Assistance Section within the Department of Justice, and I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 2128. First, if I may, in your handouts, you have a blue sheet. I just wanted to orient you for a moment to the Crime Victims Assistance Section. So you know what we're talking about with this bill. The Crime Victims Assistance Section administers two main programs. One is the Crime Victims Compensation Program that provides reimbursement to individual victims of crime or behalf of individual victims of crime for medical costs and other costs incurred as a result of a crime. The SAVE fund payments are included in what we call our crime victims compensation payments. The other program that we have, the Victim Assistance Program, administers six different state and federal grants to victim service agencies across the state, as well as our new address confidentiality program, and there's more information in that handout. So this significant piece of legislation, which was introduced, as you heard, through the work of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force, was established in the 2003 legislative session and became operational March 1st of 2004. The creation of the SAVE Fund repealed ORS 147375 that required law enforcement agencies to pay for the forensic medical evidence collection for sexual assault victims. Prior to the establishment of the fund, law enforcement agencies, due to that unfunded mandate, were responsible for the authorization and payment of those forensic medical exams, but not for the payment merely for the medical or health exam of the rape victim. As a result, the law enforcement jurisdictions faced budgetary constraints, of course, and victims were not consistently receiving forensic exams or adequate medical care in the aftermath of sexual assault. The goal of the SAVE Fund is to encourage appropriate medical care for victims of sexual assault by providing a stable, confidential means of payment for such exams. And I would like to point out that in the definition of medical assessment, it also includes the forensic evidence collection. So as you hear us talking about medical assessment, there's a partial exam, which would be the treatment, an exam to see if the person was physically all right. If they chose the complete exam, that would include the collection of forensic evidence. So when you hear us speaking about medical assessments, we're usually talking about a partial or complete exam. From March of 2004 through December of 2006, 1,315 victims of sexual assault have accessed services paid by the fund. And victims are receiving medical assessments, and forensic evidence is being collected regardless of their ability to pay. Victims are receiving medical assessments regardless of whether they report to law enforcement. And quality is assured through increasing utilization of certified sexual assault nurse examiners, or SANEs. You heard from two of them this morning already. In addition, no general fund monies are used to support this fund. As a result of a public-private partnership, individuals, hospitals, and insurance companies recognizing the benefits of this service to individuals and the healthcare system as a whole have contributed over $80,000 to the SAVE Fund thus far. I urge you to pass House Bill 2128 and maintain this important service to victims of sexual assault. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you so much. Any questions? All right, thank you. Ms. Hebb.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, and members of the committee. Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, for the record. And I would just like to add our support to this bill, for this bill, to the record, and indicate that, again, this bill will bring Oregon into compliance with the model that's established by the Department of Justice, which indicates that the provision of services, regardless of ability to pay, is the best way to protect victims and also to achieve public safety. And so we're grateful for the work of the task force in bringing this forward and appreciate the committee's time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Does anyone else wish to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2128 and open a work session on House Bill 2128. Any discussion? As I understand it, all it does is remove a sunset from something that has been happening and seems to be very successful, and we're just removing the sunset so that this can be ongoing.
Chair,
yes,
I would support moving this today. I think this is a very effective program. I think it's been administered well, and it's achieving the goals set out before. I would assume the sunset was just put on as a pilot-type thing to see if it would work, and I think we know it works. So,
thank you. Okay. Any other discussion?
Yes. Madam Chair, I apologize. I just have a question, I guess. I in reading the bill itself, on the second page, lines 17 through 19, which is what deals with the sunset date, it seems like, as I read it before, it simply says that we would receive a report on the program. I don't read it as a actual sunset. But if that's what it means, I appreciate continuing it. I'm just a little confused by the language. And perhaps someone who understands it better than I could.
Yes, here we have somebody. And could you give us your name again, please?
Yes. For the record, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the director of the Crime Victims Assistance Section for the Department of Justice. And Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, good question. This, as we were reading through this bill, I think the confusion is that in order to repeal a sunset, you have to have, have old language and new language is my understanding. The part of the bill that actually repeals the sunset is in Section 1, where it refers to Sections 9 and 11 of Chapter 789 of Oregon Laws 2003. And I have those sections here, and I'd be happy to read them to you.
Did you want to read?
Not necessarily. I just was not looking at the right language to understand the reasoning for this. So.
Okay, thank you. Good question, Representative Cowan.
I've been assured by Legislative Council that the bill, as it is written, in fact, does repeal the sunset.
Well, I have no intention of arguing with Legislative Council.
All right, any other questions that we have for here? All right, thank you so much for clarifying that.
Thank you.
So I would entertain a motion to move House Bill 2128 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Chair, I move that we pass House Bill 2128 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Potek moves House Bill 2191 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? Any further discussion?
Could I
maybe
do a clarification that I think the motion was for House Bill 2128?
What did I say? 2191? Okay. All right. You're right. 21. Thank you very much. Glad somebody picks up on these things.
She's quick.
Yes, she's quick. All right. Thank you for pointing that out, and the assistant will call the roll. Oh, and I guess I should be saying, if you vote, if you would like to see this happen, please vote aye. If not, please vote no.
Representative
Gallen?
Aye.
Representative
Gelser? Aye.
Representative
Gelser? Aye.
Representative
Potek?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
He's, excused?
Representative Chair Tomei?
Aye. The motion carries. Who would like to carry this on the floor? Who hasn't carried it? Let's see. Representative Maurer, wonderful.
Yeah.
Please do. Representative Maurer will carry the bill on the floor. And I close the work session on House Bill 2128. Thanks to all of you who worked on this. I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2193. And if the administrator will give us a brief explanation of the bill.
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 2193 is a measure that would increase fees on tanning devices, a variety of x-ray machines, and microwave oven repair equipment regulated by the Department of Human Services. It would also modify the term of registration, the period during which these tests are required for certain x-ray equipment from 1 to 2 years. According to the department, the fees haven't been changed since approximately 1993.
All right. Thank you. Do we have anybody signed up to testify on this? Oh, yes, we do. Here's a familiar face.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's a delight to be here. For the record, my name is Gail Shibley. I'm the administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health, which is one of 5 programmatic offices in Oregon's Department of Human Services Public Health Division. The Office of Environmental Health, along with the other offices of public health, work to set conditions within which people can be healthy. And my office focuses on those environmental conditions, including food safety, a topic that you will hear about obliquely, at least right after mine, radiation safety, drinking water, environmental toxicology, and others. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to use the F word in this presentation, that very nasty 3-letter word during legislative session, which is fee. I suppose I could make them plural since we are talking about multiple fees, so I guess it's a 4-letter word. All attempted jocularity aside, this is a very important topic. This office, in one iteration or another, has been the state of Oregon's sole authority for all sources of radiation, radioactive material safety since the discovery, the invention of the atom bomb in the 1940s. During that time, over those years, the physicists and others that are in my office now have done an incredible job of making sure that people in Oregon are safe, whether it was from Trojan and Hanford all the way down to tanning beds. So as I say, everything from Trojan to tanning beds, if it's any source of ionizing or non-ionizing radiation, this is the repository of safety and protection for all the people in Oregon. Part of that responsibility, of course, includes emergency preparedness and emergency response. Members of this body may be familiar with, and if regardless, you'll be hearing a lot more about something called TOPOFF. TOPOFF 4 is scheduled for October of this year, and it's signet speech for top officials 4. That is an emergency exercise that is identified in different places around the globe, and Portland gets to be the location for for that exercise in 2007. It happens to be a dirty bomb exercise. So our radiation safety and protection services, as you can imagine, will be exercised very strenuously before, during, and as a result of that effort. I just wanted to call attention to that because it's one of those activities that, frankly, most people in Oregon don't pay a lot of attention to. It's fine that you don't. We don't want you to have to worry about going to the doctor and getting burned by X-ray machines that aren't working or calibrated or operated safely. This bill provides us the opportunity to continue to inspect machines, X-ray machines, and tanning facilities on a schedule that is appropriate to assure the safety of people in the state. I will note, just as a kind of a legislative parenthesis, that radiation protection services used to get general funds, but it has been turned over to 100% federal grant and fee-driven revenues, and as a result, everybody has to pay their own way. These fees that you see before you in House Bill 2193 have not been moved for 14 years, since 1990. During that time, the workload and the costs, as you can imagine, have gone up significantly, and we are now at the point where we simply cannot continue, and we are facing a growing backlog of X-ray machines, of radioactive sources, material sources, and of tanning devices. As we project that out into the coming months and over the next couple years, it's simply something that we feel cannot continue and needs to be addressed here at this policy level. Because these fees are in statute, we are before you today to request adjustment of those fees. The folks that you don't see here with me, but who are unanimously in support of this adjustment, are the members of our statutory radiation advisory committee. That's a group of very high level, informed, educated representatives from a variety of different parts of different industries, whether physicians or professors or tanning product sales, radiochemists, dental professors, and others who have looked at this, understand the need and the safety concerns, and are unanimously in support. The Dental Association is very familiar with this bill and is neutral on this bill. The Hospital Association is aware of this bill and is neutral on this bill. There is no known opposition to this bill, and I ask for your support. I will happy to answer questions, or if you get down very deep at all. Fortunately, I have a terrific physicist here with me who is our manager of Radiation Protection Services, Terry Lindsay. And so between the two of us, we'll answer any questions you might have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? Yes, Representative Maurer.
Sure. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You answered one question, and that was, how long has it been since the fees have been raised? And I appreciate that. And in looking, I've got several questions. They're all related. And that has to do, and it's not about the fee increase, because that, to me, makes sense. But it's really on the backside about changing the length of time between these inspections. Certifications, and some of them go from 1 year to 2 years. So really, to me, that's a fee decrease for a facility. And then you have one that stays the same, and then one that goes from 3 years to 2 years. And what's the rationale? And then that actually is a double whammy for those facilities. You know, and granted, these are not significant fees, but. What is the rationale for the increase of one and the decrease in one, other than beyond consistency? Is there a rationale? Because there probably is a rationale for the structure they had before.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I appreciate the question, and the without tangling myself up into the rather interesting tendrils of the statute, we have different types of machines on different time frames for inspection, so that of the almost 9,000 x-ray machines licensed in the state of Oregon, something like 938 of them are registered in hospitals. Those get inspected, we try to, every year. Others get inspected every 2 years, and others get inspected every 3 years. And I'm not going to remember precisely which categories of machines get fall into each of those, but they include whether it's chiropractic offices or industrial or medical or podiatry or radiologist's office, etc. And so depending on the technology, depending on the usage, that and depending on the type of machine, they are inspected at those different frequencies. The statute, of course, hasn't been touched in many, many years, and so what we're trying to do is get the registration in line with the inspection schedule so that there is some coherence between those two. One. Two, we're also, I think, on lines 28 and 29 of the first page of the bill, we are trying to get away from, we think, a fairly arbitrary date of July 1 of each year, and instead provide us the flexibility to work with all the stakeholders to identify on a 1 or 2 or 3 year schedule how often those licenses ought to be up for renewal, one, and two, that within those time frames, does it make sense to spread them out rather than having an enormous crash of license renewals and then nothing for a period of time and then an enormous crash of renewals again and the revenue from them, and then we kind of live off our stores, so to speak, and get us way down, fiscally speaking, to the bottom, and then it bumps up again. It's administratively, it's not an efficient way to run the program. We think that we can do it much better by smoothing it out, and we want the statutory authority to be able to have that discussion with our stakeholders. I'm hopeful that that's responsive to your question.
Yeah, I'm sure. Actually, that didn't answer the question. I appreciate the administrative, desire to spread it out, but it doesn't address why in 1993 it was okay to recertify a dental office x-ray machine every 3 years, where now in 2007 it has to be done 2 years.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I'm sorry if that I wasn't clear, because dental offices are inspected every 2 years. Excuse me, every 3 years, like I said.
Could you identify yourself?
Say your name for the
record. Terry Lindsay, Madam Chair and Representative Maurer.
And my with whom you work?
My name and is Terry Lindsay. I'm the manager of the Radiation Protection Services section. And my understanding of this section, we're trying to clarify this original legislation. There's a disparity between the fee payment of every 2 years and the issuance of the essentially receipt for that payment in a different cycle. So that the receipt for the payment would be in 1, 2, and 3. It doesn't make sense. And in the original discussions that took place in 1993 in the legislative session, and the work that was done through the Oregon Dental Association, and with the we had a Blue Ribbon Task Force that worked together with the dental folks and lots of others. The discussions were, what is the frequency of inspections? And that's where this 1, 2, and 3 comes from. We do have that in rule. We have that in rule already, that the frequency of inspections is 1 year for hospitals and radiologists. It's 2 years for chiropractic. And I think academic, and then it's 3 year for dental, and at least industrial, I believe, is the other category. So the disparity in terms of in the section where it talks about 1, 2, and 3, we're trying to get it in to match the payment. The payment is for a 2 year period. So the receipt for that payment should be for a 2 year period. And I think somewhere in that original legislation, there was an error made. And if the, we also...
Can I stop you just a moment? Did you get your question answered? It seems to me that I'm sort of confused. The dental office is examined every 3 years, but they pay every 2 years?
They pay every 2 years. It's a biannual fee.
They pay every 2 years, but they don't get expected until every 3 years.
Correct. The representative.
That's the old way. I'm looking at what does this legislation move us to? What are we looking at in the future? I can appreciate locking up the inspection with the payment of the fee, because that the fee is really paying for the inspection. I mean, at least that's how I kind of view that. Is that an inaccurate statement?
Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer, the payment is for both the administrative cost and the inspection. And if you look at the inspection schedule and the fee for the 3-year facilities, the dental facilities, is the lowest fee. The fee for the hospitals, which is the most frequent, is the highest fee. So logically, the payment would be different for each one, but the 2-year frequency... For a 2-year frequency, for instance, for the hospitals is $228 proposed. For the dental, it's proposed to be $112. So the difference of the original crafting of the legislation back in 1993, the fees originally were $100 per year for all types of machines. And in the negotiations that took place in 1993, the fees were actually lowered in all categories. So there was $200 per 2 years. It dropped to $173 for the hospitals, down to $115 for the academic, down to $87 for the dental. And it's based upon the frequency of inspection.
Okay. That still doesn't answer the question. And the question is, what? And now it's not the fees. It is, why was it okay to inspect them every 3 years from 1993 to current, and now we're saying that there's a change in the technological standard or some industry standard says, well, 3 years is inappropriate, we need to go to 2 years.
Chairman Tomei and Representative Maurer, the inspection frequency doesn't change. That's in our rule already, and we have no intention of changing the rule in regard to that. So we'll maintain the frequency of inspections at 1, 2, and 3 years. The fee payment is in the first section here, is for a 2-year period. It's a biannual fee. And so the biannual fee for the 1-year frequency is the highest cost.
If I may, okay. Madam Chair, if I can just stop you there. You may recall, Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, that I said that it's very easy to get kind of tripped up by several strings in this statute. It's a rather intricate kind of web. Section 2 of the bill on the first page, line 15, reads, DHS shall charge a biennial registration fee. Okay? That's current statute. However, then you go to Section 3 of the bill, and you see that, well, you get a biennial fee, but it's valid for 1 year. Or it's valid for 3 years, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So we're trying to make it 2 years for a biennial fee, valid for 2 years. It's something really radical.
You're just wanting to bring in inconsistency.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, that's exactly right.
This has nothing to do with the inspection.
Correct.
This has to do with just the fee and the certificate.
Correct.
Is that where you're headed?
Chair Tomei,
are you okay?
Got
it.
Absolutely.
Would you like to become an X-ray inspector?
I've dealt with this for many years, and so
great.
Appreciate it.
Co-tech.
Oh no, I was having the light bulb that I was like, I think that's because we're all on the same page.
Okay.
Any other questions of the panel? Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. If you'll permit me on a strictly very personal note, I just want to give greetings to Representative Kotek. It's a delight to see you up there.
Thank you. It's good to see you too.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Yes.
Jane Myers, representing the Oregon Dental Association, who own a great deal of x-ray equipment. And our position, because the health division did talk to us during the interim, was to take a position of being neutral. But I don't recall that we saw that the inspection cycle was being changed from 3 to 2, and now I'm confused about
it isn't
exact, but the statute is changing it to 2 years. And the reason I bring that up, Madam Chair, yes, well, I said I'm confused, is that there is some disruption when machines are inspected in dental offices because they are down for a time. And these are, most of you have been to the dentist, you understand there's the use of the dental equipment is pretty much for every patient on every visit. So I guess I need an explanation.
And we have one for you.
And Madam Chair,
could you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Gail Shibley. And I apologize for any lack of clarity, and certainly I apologize if we've not been in sufficient ongoing communication with our good partners at the Dental Association. I know that one of your folks had been very involved in several pieces of this. But I just want to clarify that this bill does not change any inspection cycles. So dental equipment will not be inspected with any greater frequency as a result. This has to do with making sure that the validity of the license fits with the fee that's on the first page that is current existing statute. It's just making sure that a two-year fee is valid for 2 years rather than 1 year or 3 years. I'm hopeful that that's...
You know what I would like to do is we're not going to be having a work session today. I'm going to let you folks go out into the hall and go to some office.
We can take up all your time to have this conversation.
To discuss this. And we're not going to have a work session, but our intent is to pass this eventually. And it will go on to the Ways and Means Committee. Yes.
Madam Chair, I'm comfortable with what Gail has said on the record here. It sounds like we're just changing the validity of the license, but not the inspection thing, and that's
good. Great. Good. Thank you very much. Any other questions or concerns? Anyone from the audience who wishes to speak? Okay, then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2193 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2290. And I'd like to give us a brief explanation.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. House Bill 2290 would clarify the kinds of facilities covered by the Department of Human Services Foodborne Illness Prevention Program, and it's also linked to emergency incident response efforts. Under the current statute, just to give a little bit of background, the Department of Agriculture generally oversees health regulations for entities like food processors, food retailers, grocery stores, deli, and other related entities, while the DHS would generally oversee health regulations for restaurants. The measure would clarify these roles by changing the current statute to reflect other statutory changes that were made in the 2003 session.
Okay. And I believe we have testimony from a couple of gentlemen. Introduce yourself, please.
Yes,
and I would like to invite you, push that away from you, of the head of it. Push a little bit away from you. Right. That's perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, I'm Dalton Hobbs, Assistant Director for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And we're here today to speak in favor of 2290. And I have with me Mike Dovro, who is our assistant administrator of our food safety division, who is responsible for the daily operations and the daily interface with the health division and in enforcing Oregon's food safety code. So I'll have Mike talk a little bit about why this is necessary and why we at the Department of Agriculture ask that this piece of legislation be passed.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mike Govro, Assistant Administrator of the Food Safety Division, Oregon Department of Agriculture. The purpose of this bill is to clarify language in ORS 624.495, and the committee administrator did a nice job of summarizing this. Oregon's two food statutes, ORS 616 and 624, delineate the division of regulatory authority over food establishments between the Department of Health Services, which is responsible for food service facilities such as restaurants and catering operations, and the Department of Agriculture, which is responsible for facilities that produce, distribute, and process food. In ORS 624.495, the Department of Human Services is charged with preventing the spread of communicable disease through food dispensing facilities and for effective and rapid response to terrorism events related to food dispensing facilities. The concern is that the term food dispensing facility is not defined and may lead to confusion about the roles and responsibilities of our respective agencies at the time of a bioterrorism crisis. This bill simply proposes to change the language from food dispensing facility to food service facility. The term food service facility is defined and falls clearly within the responsibility of the Department of Human Services. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of the witnesses? All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Does anyone else wish to testify in this bill? Okay. We're just having a hearing on this. We will not be having a work session. And it will eventually have a work session on this, and I intend to pass it unless I have some reason not to. And I will close the public hearing on 2290 and open a public session on House Bill 2027. Pardon? I'm sorry. I closed the hearing on 2027 and open a work session on 2027. Thank you. And Andy.
Thank you, Chair. There is a little bit of, I would say, confusion, but I want to give an explanation because there's some related bills related to 2027. So I'm going to pass around Senate Bill 42, which you probably don't have because it may come up for some discussion. And the related bill, there are two bills that are related that this committee has already had a public hearing on. Those would be 2027 and 2194. And as the chair just mentioned, the work session here is on 2027. So one of those. House Bill 20, just to refresh everyone's memory or understanding of 2027, as written without amendment, House Bill 2027 would require the Department of Human Services to adopt rules permitting exceptions to the operation of foster care home providers. This is the Home Alone Bill, some have referred to. Under the current writing of 2027, this would be only for the requirement that the provider or substitute caregiver be on duty 24 hours a day. So there is a before I get to the amendment, or I'll let Representative Gelser, it's her amendment, I think she could summarize it most clearly, but wanted to clarify that the the difference between 2194 and 2027 would be between sections 2 and 3. 2194 would actually create the authority for DHS to adopt or have discretion on the home loan requirement for both the residency, living in the home requirement, and the 24-hour being there requirement. That would be 2194. 2027, as written, would only be for the 24-hour requirement, not the residency or that you live in the home requirement. So without confusing you anymore, maybe I'll let Representative Gelser explain there is the amendment for 2027.
Great. Thank you. We heard testimony a week ago in our public hearing about how this change in existing practice had impacted people across the state of Oregon that had developmental disabilities and their ability to spend time at home alone. There was an effort during the special session to move some of this language quickly so that we could revert to previous practice for these individuals. And as a result, that's one of the reasons why there are multiple versions of a bill that does roughly the same thing. Senator Morissette had kind of taken the lead in this building and in drafting language that would allow that reversion to the home alone provision, and that came as Senate Bill 42, which was introduced as a committee bill from the Senate Interim Committee on Public Health. And prior to the public hearings, I did speak with Senator Morissette's office to try to figure out how do we get all of these things together so that we can move this legislation through the building as quickly as possible to allow these people to again have the freedoms that they had enjoyed prior to the new understanding of statute. And so I worked with legislative counsel and have proposed amendments to House Bill 2027. These are the Dash 1 amendments. And what it does is substitute Section 4 of Senate Bill 42 into Section 4 of House Bill 2027. What this does is makes that change that we heard about last week between the shall and the may. So it's requiring the department to develop rules that make that exception. The place where it would not be the same between Senate Bill 42 and House Bill 2027 is in Section 2. House Bill 42 reads, except as provided in subsection 4 of this section, a provider must live in the home that is to be licensed. That except as provided isn't in 2027. However, Section 4 doesn't give an exception for the provider living in the home. These are foster providers that need to live in the home. So I believe that these amendments would accomplish the aim that everybody is after, which is giving these individuals with developmental disabilities the ability to spend some time at home alone rather than having to be dropped off at Target or a hotel in order to practice their independence.
Representative Gelser, has Senate Bill 42, has that already been heard in the Senate?
Senate Bill 42 has been heard in the Senate.
And it passed?
And it passed.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions of Representative Gelser? Yes, Representative Callan.
I understand this is a work session on 2027, but I'm just confused about the need for 2027, 2194, and Senate Bill 42. Is there any way to just combine these all into one?
Representative Gelser has a response to
I
that.
Do, and that is part of the goal of the Dash 1 amendments. What it would do, I would suggest that we move 2027 with the Dash 1 amendments, not move 2194, and then we have one that's ready to go on the Senate side, one that's ready to go on the House side that are roughly identical, and whichever way happens to move most quickly is the way to get these individuals their independence back. So I think that depends on whose third readings come up first. So it makes them roughly identical.
Okay, follow up. I might.
Representative Collins.
Then if one of these it passes successfully, will that mean that we don't need 2194?
That's exactly
is that what
right.
I'm understanding?
That's
correct?
Exactly.
Sorry,
right.
I had to get
no,
that in my brain.
Excellent question.
Thank you.
Any other questions or concerns?
Madam Chair, just as a follow-up, since I'm new and don't know how this works, I do hope that if we are able to make the recommendation to the House to pass this, that there is a way to encourage us to bring it to the floor rather quickly so that it can move through the process to meet the needs of these people who have been waiting for about 18 months.
And does it has an immediate?
It does.
Present, yes. Okay.
It does.
Section 2, emergency is declared. That's terrific. I think that's a great idea. Any other questions or concerns? You look.
No concern.
Madam
Chair, I just wish that this had not happened. This whole circumstance had not happened, and we not have to deal with it now.
Absolutely. There's so many unintended consequences when we try to do the right thing, and later we find out because of some little quirk in the legislation, something happens that we did not intend. So that's why a lot of these sort of housekeeping bills keep coming back to us, just to correct a mistake that we had not been intended. Representative Cowan.
Madam Chair, if I could just reiterate that and the need for moving this quickly was one of the first contacts I had as a newcomer here from a constituent with a child who had been in the same foster home for 20 years. And suddenly was finding herself locked out when she came home from work. That's just unconscionable. And so I wholeheartedly support this. The only reason for my questions was to try to get the product that we can move the most quickly.
Absolutely. Let me see if there's any question over here. Representative Gelfair.
Madam Chair, on the issue of unintended consequences, we did hear testimony from individuals that were concerned that there could be unintended consequences for seniors and people with physical disabilities with this bill, and I trust that the department in their rulemaking process will be reaching out to those stakeholders and looking at the language that requires that residents' health and safety is protected so that we don't come back in the next session with unintended consequences for those populations.
Good point, Representative Gelfair. Any other questions or concerns? I will entertain a motion. Oh, number one, we have to move the dash one amendments.
Madam Chair, I would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2027.
Representative Gelfair has moved the dash amendments to 2127. Any questions, concerns, discussion? I think this we can just do a verbal vote on this. All in favor say aye. Opposed say no.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the motion carries. Okay, Representative Gelfair.
Yes, I move. What was the one? I move passage of House Bill 2027 with the dash one amendments with a due pass recommendation to the floor.
Representative Gelfair moves House Bill 2027 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any objection? Any discussion? The clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative
Cowan? Aye. Representative Gelfair?
Aye.
Representative
Gillian? Aye.
Representative
Coulson? Aye.
Representative
Maurer?
Aye.
Representative
Coulson?
Yes.
Chair Tomei?
Aye.
The
motion carries, and...
Yes, pretty close. So, back to Representative Gelfair Cowan, I'm not sure. We seem to be putting bills off. Is there any way for us to expedite this on the floor? Is that a letter from the committee asking for an exception to the current rule? Because it would be nice to implement this ASAP, so I don't know how we do that.
Representative Gelfair, I assume you would like to carry this on the floor, I understand.
I would like to carry this to the floor, and I would be happy to do whatever I could to support requesting that this bill move earlier than March.
And I will do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And thanks for taking care of the amendments.
Yes. Any other questions or concerns? All right. The motion carries. And Representative Gelfair will carry the bill to the floor. And I close the work session on House Bill 2027. And do we have any other business that we should be attending to? I can't believe that we're through at a quarter of 10.
Disgusting.
Hey, you were late.
Madam Chair, please. My ruts returned me back to the Judiciary Committee this morning.
Okay, wonderful. We will have a meeting at 8:30 on Monday morning. Hope to see you all there. And have a great weekend. And the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.